Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So it's my pleasure to welcome to the G word today Henrietta Hopkins and Susanna Kinsella from the public dialogue firm Hopkins Van Mill. Welcome both to the podcast.
Hello, Chris.
Lovely to be here.
It's great to have you guys. I should clarify that Genomics England are working with Hopkins Van Mill at the moment on a public dialogue project, and we're gonna get into some of that at the moment. Before we dive into that, maybe you could explain to me a bit about Hopkins Van Mill. Henrietta, I'm assuming that because your surname is Hopkins, you are one of the founders of Hopkins Van Mill. Is that right? What was the vision and what does Hopkins Van Mill do?
Yes, so that's, that is a story in itself, a bit, Chris. But we founded in 2005, and it was me and a colleague, Anita Van Mill, hence Hopkins Van Mill. And we actually set up originally to work in more in the museum and heritage sector. We both came from museums and heritage backgrounds. So this is a wiggly journey we've come on. But we set up to support engagement with museums, with the heritage sector across diverse populations, and including doing international work. And then gradually we found ourselves over time doing much more science and technology work. And in 2008, we did a very long form deliberation on environment, which led us really to where we are today and doing a lot more. We still do have strong feelings and strong support for the museums and heritage sector, but our work is now a lot more around broader subjects, science, technology, health, data, and really a lot of other social research areas, which I think what we like to embrace is those dialogic problems which are either emotionally or technologically challenging. That's how we cover the wide scope of what we work in. So we were founded, over 15 years ago now.
I wonder if you could bring to life for me a bit what a public dialogue looks like. We talk a lot about public engagement and so on, but that can range from everything, I guess, from a survey to online pieces to lightweight conversations to full dialogue. Like, what does this look like when you're engaging on a topic?
What it is a commitment, both from those commissioning it and those taking part, and obviously us as designing it. It's a process which allows the commissioning body and society to get to the heart of people's values, their perceptions, their attitudes, what they found challenging about a topic. So it takes time. So we started this project with you in October, and we're launching now in July. So it takes time, and that's in fact quite a short time scale for some of these projects. And what public dialogue does, it allows citizens, people, members of the public, you people like you and me, and broader than that, to come together to learn about an issue, to talk with specialists in that issue, to engage with each other in that space, and to consider a whole range of diverse perspectives. And in doing so, as I've said, uncover key tensions, key values, and spark new thinking, which can inform policy. And I should just sort of add to that that the policy areas that are best fitted for dialogue are ones which are not formed yet, which are an idea, a theory, to get people's views so that they really can influence the development of that public policy, whatever it is.
That's really helpful. And Susanna, tell us a bit about your background and how you fit into the picture at Hopkins Van Mill.
So I liked Henrietta's use of the word wiggly, and I guess that's true of me as well. I started history at university, but I spent most of my time actually thinking I wanted to be a journalist because I liked listening to people, I liked asking questions, and I liked writing. So what else would you be than a journalist? Perfect. What I didn't like about the idea of being a journalist was doing things like doorstepping people and, you know, extracting headlines out of them at a traumatic point in their life. So instead, I ended up working in advertising and in market research. So I worked in Toronto, I worked in London, talking to people about tea and body wash and doing research focus groups and research around that. Until in my early 30s, I saw an advert by the Central Office of Information. So that was a government agency that said, we want to bring in people with commercial experience of insight and research and communication into the public sector to work on, you know, some thorny social issues. So I joined the COI, as it was then, in about 2007. And interestingly, as Henrietta was working on one of her first public dialogues, the first one that I worked on was on for a body called the Organ Donation Task Force. And they were looking at the issue of, should we move to an opt-out system for organ donation instead of, you know, carrying the donor card, etc. So we worked on building a public dialogue that involved the public, involved transplant surgeons, involved ethicists, about should we make this big shift, this big societal shift towards presumed consent, presuming that everyone is an organ donor. And that was my introduction to public dialogue, and have been working on it ever since, and joined Henrietta at Hopkins Van Mill about 5 years ago. And the first one I think we worked on there was for the Royal Society, looking at how we address issues around genetic technologies, thinking about it for applications in humans, applications in food, and applications in animals. And that was the first project I worked with Henrietta on.
There's an amazing breadth there, right? And I think I'm right in saying that partly, I'm sure, because of the public dialogues that you led through that process, there has been broad support for that switch to opt out rather than opt in for organ donation. And you touched also on different applications of genetic technology, obviously a subject close to our heart at Genomics England. Let's talk a little bit about the newborn sequencing project that you've been working on with us and with ScienceWise. Maybe, Henrietta, could you give us a little bit of the background to the project and how you got involved and what kind of questions you were looking at? And then we can maybe dive in a bit into how it played out and where the conversations are landing.
Yeah, so the programme was part of ScienceWise's public dialogue programme supported by UKRI, and we were very pleased to submit a proposal, which was accepted. And working with the wonderful project team, which was comprised of team members from Genomics England and also UK National Screening Committee, who were partners in the project, and also ScienceWise, because they have a programme of support and mentoring as you go through, which really challenges the programme. We were also fortunate enough to have an oversight group set up of people from Genomics England, from across the perspectives that we might want to talk about in terms of newborn screening, and also people from the Genomics England 100,000 Genome Participant Panel to bring their challenges to our process to make sure it's really robust. And the main question we were looking at is really broad, which is fascinating always for dialogue. But the question is, what are the implications for the NHS and for society of using whole genome sequencing in newborn screening? So that was quite a lot to unpick in a dialogue process, but the context in which we were looking at that was split into two. So the first one was the potential use of whole genome sequencing as a technology in addition to or to replace some parts of the current NHS newborn screening programme. And then additionally, the potential novel or alternative uses of whole genome sequencing in newborns. So in the first case, we're looking at potential harms, potential benefits for the baby throughout their lifetime, but also for parents and for the wider family and for others in society and for the NHS. But when we're looking at the second context about novel or alternative uses, then really exploring different purposes for the technology. For example, lifetime monitoring of conditions, pharmacogenomics, family planning might come in there, research. And all of these aspects we dug through using case studies, live presentations. And I'm sure we'll come to this, but it's one of the pieces of magic of dialogue is when there's the interaction with the public dialogue participants and the specialists, and working together, they come up with something new, something interesting, something which added a real value to the topic.
So there's these two, as you say, these two sort of quite distinct questions. One is, at the moment, a newborn baby gets the sort of heel prick test that parents will be familiar with. And I think from memory that looks at something like nine conditions. And we're saying, right, actually newborn sequencing could expand it from nine to, a few hundred. And then there's probably that much bigger and longer term question of what then happens if someone's whole genome has been sequenced, if they've decided to opt into that at birth, what does that mean for their life course? And I'm interested, did you have some people in the groups who said, like, absolutely, yes, do the sort of newborn test instead of or alongside the heel prick, but then just delete the data or just move on? How did views kind of emerge on these two separate topics? Maybe Susanna, you could bring that to life from some of the dialogues that you've led.
So I guess to directly answer a question, people didn't kind of sit in one camp or the other. And for the big reason that they saw that it was important, yes, to get a diagnosis for their child, but they could also see the benefit of the data that stemmed from their child's genomic sequencing being used to help understand the prevalence of rare diseases, develop treatments, etc. So for many people in the dialogue, they held the two uses in equal importance, in fact. And a particular thing that struck home to people was the importance of having genomic data that is reflective of the population. So they were pretty shocked and horrified and disappointed, very disappointed, about the idea that genomic data perhaps to date has been more reflective of a Northern European population. And they felt the idea going forward should be that no matter what your ethnic background, you should have confidence that you can get an accurate test and there shouldn't be this disparity. And so that, for many people, was quite a big driving force about not just using the data for an individual's diagnosis, but use it to create this really comprehensive database to enable research and treatments to benefit everyone, not just based on your ethnicity, for example.
Absolutely. And without wanting to overly pitch the work of Genomics England too much, that's alongside the newborns research that we're doing with you and others, we're actually actively underway to try to address that diversity gap at the moment in partnership with various community groups and so on. And as you were going through the dialogues, I guess maybe some individual reflections from each of you, what were the things that either you found most inspiring or surprising or fundamental as you had these conversations? Maybe Henrietta first.
Sure. So surprising, I think the way participants grasped the evidence and took it so seriously and really, really invested in exploring these issues. So they've come to three sort of main findings with that participants, I mean, they were broadly supportive of whole genome sequencing for newborn screening, but they expect in this nuanced picture that Susanna's painted that proper consideration is given to the design and the planning of any future use of this technology, including a really, really robust pilot research study and ensuring proper resources, investments and safeguards are in place. And perhaps we can talk about that. But I think the way participants really took this program to their hearts and really explored it. And I wonder if we could perhaps talk about some of the groups we ran. So we ran a broader group of people, broadly recruited from the UK population. But we also ran alongside that people who came from groups that might have a particular perspective on using this technology for newborn screening. And that included a group of new and expectant parents. And obviously, they were very close to the newborn screening process. And so what they were calling for was really solid communication about if you integrate whole genome sequencing in whatever form for newborn screening, then really you've got to communicate what that means, not only to parents and future parents, but to the whole of society, so that there we don't get a scare the horses situation. We do get proper consideration of this by society. One of the other groups was a young adults group who, and they were stunning in their grasp of the subject and their wish to explore the depths of it. One of their key concerns was to make sure people really understood that 21st century families don't come with a mum and a dad and two children. There are many forms of family in 21st century UK, and that included, you know, what are the considerations if children are adopted? What does that mean for the newborn screening? What if they've come to the UK at a young age and haven't had newborn screening? Does that give them a differential in society that isn't warmly welcomed? Fascinating things on climate change. So if we're going to collect all this huge data on a population's genomic data, what will that mean for, in terms of computing power? How much energy will that need to drive that? If people are using their genomic data in a sort of preventive sense, so that they understand better the genetic conditions they might have and how to treat them, then will people live longer? And what impact will that have on planetary health? So they brought some things to the dialogue that I think no one really expected and are important, I think, as Genomics England and the UK National Screening Committee think about this further.
That's fantastic. And I love those kind of conversations for exactly the reasons you outline. And I think things like the energy implications is spot on. And obviously things like cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and so on are coming under criticism for the energy footprint of all the compute power. And indeed, we've just been having conversations internally about how much bigger our data footprint is going to become over the coming years and what we do about that, both from a cost and energy consumption, a carbon footprint and so on perspective. It's huge. It always makes me feel slightly reassured when we have these conversations with young adults, how smart, engaged, on it they are, because you think, well, we need you to solve a load of these problems over the next 30, 40 years. So I'm always reassured that they're so engaged and thoughtful. Susanna, how about you? Were there any particular moments that stuck out?
I think for me particularly, it was working with the participants from the genetic conditions group. And something that we bring out in the report that they talk about just really, really passionately was around the fact that this whole thing is not just about getting a diagnosis. That's helpful. A diagnosis is definitely important. And a treatment plan is very important. But it's also how you live with this, how you live with this condition that you've been told you have. And so within that, people talked about the importance of involving parent support networks, health condition charities, and how they work with the NHS so that you create this kind of holistic support that goes beyond just a treatment plan and just a diagnosis. And so they really wanted to see how do we develop this kind of support system over time to ensure that people don't fall down when they have this diagnosis. So that was particularly strong. As you can imagine, people in the genetic conditions groups that had themselves gone through this process of diagnosis, and some felt that they perhaps hadn't had that sense of support about living with a condition over time.
And one of the conversations that comes up a lot in, for example, press stories on this topic or academic-y, think-tanky groups who've been thinking about this is, what do you tell to whom, when, about what's going on in their genome? Huge question. And often people say, well, why would you do newborn screening? Because why on earth would you tell some newborn baby that they're at higher risk of this or that cancer when they're 50? To which the response is, of course, well, you wouldn't, right? But I'm really interested, what were the views of the different groups on what they would want to know or not know, or how they would be helped to make those choices in this kind of context where the screening is happening?
It's interesting that you say across the different groups. In many ways, there was vastly more similarity, particularly on that issue about what you tell and when. There was a lot of agreement across the groups that two things need to come in mind. One, is it a condition that will affect the child in early childhood? And secondly, there's something you can do about it. And I think possibly the something you can do about it is a really interesting part, because it's not just about curing it or preventing it. It is also about whether it's lifestyle treatments or therapies that can make life easier, make my life more comfortable. So they had quite a broad sense of what that kind of actionability or intervention could be that was beyond just a curative or preventative treatment. And an interesting spark of that conversation came up when we talked about a condition where people have high cholesterol, so hypercholesterolemia, familial hypercholesterolemia. And people talked about this idea that if that is detected in a child, the child can't really be treated with that until they're 8, 9, or 10 years old at the earliest, perhaps with statins. But they were intrigued by this idea that a parent could be living with this and living with a threat of a heart condition, higher risk of a heart attack. And actually, they could be informed and put on statins, and they saw a direct benefit to the child of simply a parent who doesn't die on them when they're in their 30s or 40s. So that was a really interesting example of where they did see it as a direct benefit to the child, even though it was to the parent in terms of their health, most particularly.
It's a stark example of how our genome connects us, right, to other people. I mean, that sort of parent-child relationship is obviously the most direct, but also that sense of a connection with the community or sort of ancestral group that you're from as well, or the community, as you mentioned earlier, about sort of parent support networks and so on, of other people who have that same kind of glitch in the genome. And Henrietta, you mentioned earlier that one of the high-level kind of umbrella findings from the work was, if I can kind of play it back broadly, yes, do this, but do it properly, and think through all the implications, think through the support, do a proper pilot study, and so on. If we want to unpick that a bit, how would you summarise the findings, and I guess the implications for us, for the NHS, as we start thinking through what such a pilot study could look like?
Yeah, so I suppose there are two halves to that answer. But I mean, obviously, our broad question was about the implications. So if we think about the implications, for example, the NHS, is it that the NHS could use this genomic data to become more prevention focused, because things could be done earlier to catch things before they become a massive problem? There was a general sense that more prevention focused approach would be good. But this also has the project of whole genome sequencing for newborn screening has big implications for workforce within the NHS. You know, are there the midwives, the health visitors, and in fact throughout the health sector, are there people who understand what this whole genome sequencing for newborn screening could do, what to do to help and support people? So there's a whole training and knowledge awareness piece that participants were very keen was taken up by the NHS. I mean, Susanna's mentioned the sort of equitable rollout idea, and that was really, really important, that there shouldn't be some sort of postcode lottery embedded into this, or a two-tier system of healthcare. And so the time to prepare the programme properly was really at the forefront of people's minds. And some were very concerned about the cost. You know, what would this cost? Not only in terms of doing genomic testing, but or using whole genome sequencing within the screening programme, but then the longer term implications of understanding more about people's genetic health and what that would cost the NHS. There was also concern in a time of COVID vaccine scepticism. Would saying to people that whole genome sequencing was being used as a technology here put them off what is already a very successful newborn screening program? And so that's why communication was really important. I mean, we've got lots of safeguarding points. A very important point people made about, okay, so if as a society we agree that this should cautiously be implemented over time, what's going to happen with changes of government or changes of legislation? So future-proofing the protections that are being called for now in society so that they can't be thrown out on a whim was also very important. So, I mean, it's a very rich report, Chris, and I think one of the things we've found is that in taking such a long time, working with so many groups and having so many workshops, we have a very rich and findings which will bear fruit over time.
Absolutely. And if people who are listening to the podcast want to find out more and track down the report, which we're speaking actually just on the eve of publication, it's going out tomorrow, what should they search in their search engine of choice?
It will be very prominently available on Genomics England, UK National Screening Committee and Hopkins Van Mills website. But we had very interesting discussions. We even asked participants what we should call the report. And in the end, we just decided to call it what it is, which is a public dialogue, whole genome sequencing for newborn screening. So I think actually, if you Google whole genome sequencing for newborn screening tomorrow, you'll find it.
Bingo. That's great. And so an incredibly deep and, as you say, rich seam of insights for us to mine there in the coming kind of weeks, months, and years. And I think an incredibly powerful validation of this kind of process of really deep and thoughtful engagement with a representative set of groups of people, although not necessarily statistically representative in that sense, but representative of society in the sense of the different communities that you brought together. If we step right back and think, you two are kind of immersed in this in your day-to-day lives, what are some other topics that you think we should be ensuring we take this kind of deliberative and immersive approach to as a society, either to do with genomics, data and tech, or anything at all?
Really interesting. I think what came up a lot in our discussions was this thought of, just because we can do it, should we do it? And so there were lots of questions and thoughts around, well, people, for example, talked about the internet. They talked about the internet is out there, and the idea that you can put a lid on the internet is ridiculous. The internet is spreading throughout the world. It does what it does. And so people were reflected on that in the same way about genomic technologies, and really were fascinated, frightened, interested in how do we make decisions about how it's used and where do we draw the line. And so people quite naturally started talking about, well, we're talking about using this when a child is born. What about its use before it's born? What about its use when we're thinking about having families? And what does that mean? What kind of decisions are we making? And what are we trying to use this technology to do? So certainly I think amongst our participants, there was a huge sense that this is as much, if not more, about the ethics as it is about the science. And they really want to see discussions and involvement of public in that as we progress over the coming years. So I think that's going to be so important. What do we use this for?
It's fascinating if we cast our minds back to, I guess, kind of the mid-90s when the internet was first becoming mainstream. I don't think anyone could have thought at that point that one of the main concerns we would have 20 years later was teenage mental health because of social media, right? It takes two or three steps to get there, maybe more. And so I guess this kind of process is so useful for us at this stage of the curve with something like genome sequencing, to try and use that to look around the corner, so to speak, to really think through by bouncing ideas off each other, by engaging with different groups, as we've talked about, how can we think both about the benefits we might not have expected and also the risks that that we'll need to manage as we go through the process. And Henrietta, how about you? What if you were going to apply the tools of sort of deep and rich dialogue to other themes or questions, what would you bring to the fore?
Yeah, well, I suppose you would expect me to agree with Susanna, absolutely. But I think ethical issues, I think people have become scared for the reasons you've mentioned before, you know, GM foods, for example. And they're a bit scared about asking for public views on really thorny ethical issues. And I say, please do. I think it's such a useful way of understanding how society will react, and that's better to know before it's a monster in the press. That it's much better to know. I think one of the areas I'd really like to work on is about trust. And we've done some work on trust. We did the Foundations of Fairness with the Ada Lovelace Institute in Understanding Patient Data. But I think much more can be done about public trust in data use, public trust in data use by commercial entities, public trust in industry working with academics, because that is the future. These sort of academic industry collaborations around genomics is a very good example. But that won't make much headway without public trust. And we really felt areas where people were saying trust is missing and trust needs to be built. So transparency and trust issues. And I would have said a week ago or a couple of weeks ago that I really wanted to do something around COVID-19 recovery and what that means and what are the social justice, the ethical implications around COVID-19 recovery. But I'm very pleased to report that we're working with the Nuffield Council on Bioethics and the UK Pandemic Ethics Accelerator on that very topic as of 2 weeks ago. So that's one thing off my wish list, and I hope we do a good job there. But I think the ethical implications, social justice issues around genomics, data use, health tech, and many other subjects would be fascinating.
Well, you've pressed pretty much all of our hot buttons there in the last 2 minutes. So we'll look forward to more dialogues on these incredibly important topics. Well, thank you both so much, both for the work that you've done on this public dialogue and for coming and joining us on the podcast today. Hopefully we'll have a chance in some period of time to kind of reprise some of these other topics through other dialogues. Keep doing your work in the meantime. It's fantastic work.
Thanks, Chris. Will do.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's really, really great.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.